Welcome to this podcast series on communicating European Union environmental law. I'm Áine Riall, co-director of the Centre for Law and the Environment here at University College Cork. The centre is a focal point for our research, teaching and advocacy work in the field of environmental law. And we are delighted to host this podcast series. The series is part of a larger outreach project funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative. And the aim of the podcast series is to explore different aspects of European Union environmental law in a manner which appeals to a wide audience. For this podcast, I'm joined by Leo Flynn. Leo is a graduate of the UCC School of Law. He is legal advisor in the legal service of the European Commission and based in Brussels. Leo is participating in this podcast in a personal capacity and is not in any way representing the view of the European Commission. Leo Flynn, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Áine. It's my pleasure.
To start off, can you tell me a little about your career to date and your current role at the European Commission?
Certainly. I've been working at the European Commission since 2002. So that's coming up to 20 years now. Within the legal service of the Commission, we're divided into various teams by subject matter. And our job is always the same. There's three functions that we carry out. We give advice to the College of Commissioners and to the operational services, the Directorate General of the Commission. We look at draft legislation, draft decisions, draft legal instruments, and we carry out control of legal issues, everything from the quality of drafting through to respect of fundamental principles of union law, through to coherence within a given legal field. And then the third thing that we do is that we represent the Commission in litigation. Most of the litigation work is in front of the Union Courts in Luxembourg, but also we would represent the Commission in international tribunals, in the Strasbourg Court occasionally, in the courts of third countries. Some of my colleagues have had cases in front of the US Supreme Court, for example. And all of that work basically ensures that what we're doing is we are concerned with issues of legality. One of the constraints that we have to operate within is that we need to be able to litigate in all of the official languages of the European Union. So that's 24 languages. Until very recently, there was always an asterisk beside Irish because there had never been a case in Irish that had gone through at least as far as a hearing. But as you know, we have a pending case at the moment in a reference from the High Court in Irish on the language regime that is used for animal feed products. And we recently had an opinion of the Advocate General. So one of my colleagues, Cara Cunniff, had the pleasure of representing the Commission through Irish for the first time. So that's what I'm doing now. And I've moved through teams over my almost 20 years. Before I came to the legal service, I worked at the Court of Justice for 5 years as a referendaire, as a legal assistant to the judge of Irish nationality. I had two bosses. My first boss, Mr. John Murray, went back to Dublin after 2.5 years of me being with him and joined the Supreme Court, and his successor, Fidelma Mackin, she kept the team that she found, and I worked with her for another 2.5 years. Before that, as it were, between leaving Cork, which by definition is the great break point in life, and going over to Luxembourg, I studied and then worked as a legal academic in the UK, first in the north of England, in Leeds for a few years, and then in London at King's College. And so that's basically the path that has taken me through to what I'm doing now.
That's really an absolutely fascinating account, Leo, of the trajectory of your career and the different engagements you've had, both in the academic world and then when you moved to the more European Union side of things in the practice sense. And of course, the reference to your breaking from your Cork roots being crucially important as well. And we've had the pleasure, of course, of you coming to Cork and to the School of Law on many occasions and speaking so enthusiastically with our students and being so open and so positive about the career opportunities, etc., within the EU institutions. And we're always, of course, indebted to you for that and look forward to having you back to visit us again very soon. But it's clear that a significant part of your role is concerning the enforcement of EU law. And you mentioned legality, of course, which is at the heart of this. Can you tell us, are there particular enforcement challenges in the area of European Union environmental law that might be of interest to our listeners?
When you're talking about enforcement, you're working from the premise that you already have a set of rules to be enforced. And those rules may arise directly under the European treaties, or they may be found in instruments of secondary legislation adopted by the Union institutions. And for both kinds of rules, for the rules of primary law and for the rules of secondary law, one of the key tasks that the Commission has under the Treaty of European Union is that it is to be a guardian of union law under the control of the Court of Justice, but it is required to ensure the application of the treaties and of measures adopted by the institutions pursuant to them. And that's in Article 17, paragraph 1 of the Treaty on European Union. So we see this as a central task that the institution has. In terms of the means by which union law is applied or enforced, you need to distinguish between the different channels by which union law is applied. So, as I say, we're assuming that we have our rule of environmental law in this case. And there's a number of different ways in which the Commission might be involved in its enforcement. To take, I suppose, the example we're most familiar with, a lot of union law is designed to be taken over by the member states to put in domestic law and to be enforced in the same way as any other norm of domestic law will be enforced. But from time to time, there will be a dispute about what the union law rule means, how it should be interpreted. And this will come up in front of a national court. And the national court has the power, and in some circumstances the obligation, to refer questions of interpretation of union law to the Court of Justice. Whenever a reference of that kind is made, whenever a national court asks the court, how do I interpret this particular rule, then the court receives observations from the Commission and from member states and from parties in front of the national judge. The Commission always intervenes. You can have cases in which no member state makes observations. You can have cases even in which the parties in front of the national court don't make observations, but the Commission always makes observations. For us, this is one of the main channels by which we go for the enforcement of union law, working on the basis that the national judge is the ordinary judge of union law, and he or she is, if you like, the one who's doing the hard work alongside the national administration and citizens in ensuring that union law in the field of the environment is respected. The second way in which the Commission would get involved in the enforcement of union law in the field of the environment is that the Commission may be given tasks to discharge. So, for example, to authorise or to prohibit certain substances because of their effects on the environment. And so the Commission itself is an administration, a decision taker. And just like any decision which is made, for example, in a statutory instrument in Ireland or in a decision which is taken within the civil service, the Commission decisions are challengeable in front of the General Court in Luxembourg. And the people who are in my position, our job when such litigation arises is to defend the decision that the Commission has taken. In the field of the environment, there is a particular issue that comes up, which is that for union administrative law, in order to be able to challenge a decision, you have to show that the decision is one that's been sent to you. Or if it hasn't been sent to you, it's almost as though you're an invisible addressee. It must be something that concerns you in a way that singles you out from the population as a whole. And this can be a problem in the field of the environment, because of course, the environment is of something that is of common interest. And if you like, it's difficult to say who speaks for the environment. So in the field of union administrative law, the European Union signed up a number of years ago to a convention concluded in Aarhus in Denmark, which seeks to put in place wider mechanisms to make it easier for NGOs, for third sector bodies who are interested in environmental protection, to be able to get into court. And so that's something that I've been involved in on a number of occasions. I've had litigation which has been brought by NGOs who are challenging commission decisions authorizing, for example, the import of genetically modified soybeans. And that decision taken by the commission was addressed to basically the soybean producing company. The NGO is not happy, and the NGO asks the commission to reconsider its decision. The commission takes a decision in response to the NGO's request, and that second decision of the commission can be challenged in front of the general court. So that's the second way by which we see enforcement of environmental law norms, principles, and rules in annulment actions taken against the commission in the general court. And then the third mechanism is that the commission has a very powerful weapon in Article 258 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. Article 258 gives the commission the power to bring member states before the Court of Justice for a declaration that they have failed to comply with their obligations under union law. And I said just there that what the court gives is a declaration. And usually it's a declaration is enough in the sense that the treaty creates an obligation for the member state to follow up on a judgment that has been handed down. Article 260, paragraph 1 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union says that the member state must take the necessary measures to comply with the judgment of the court. But sometimes that can take a long time. And in the past, you were left with a declaratory judgment of the Court of Justice. You could think about some things that you could do with that judgment. For example, maybe you could take that judgment of the court, go back to the courts in the member state and bring an action against the state for damages as a result of any losses that had been created by the breach of union law that the court had identified. But that particular mechanism is not straightforward, particularly in the field of the environment. It's very difficult to identify a specific confined loss that has arisen for an individual that he or she is going to be able to translate into an action for damages. And also, very often in the field of the environment, what is ultimately motivating people to bring actions isn't the monetary dimension. It's much more the substantive state of environmental protection. What we have in Article 260 that I referred to already is not just a requirement for the member state to take follow-up measures. We also have a mechanism that allows the commission to go back to the Court of Justice and to look this time for a ruling that the member state has failed to comply with the previous judgment of the court. And if the court finds that there has been a failure to comply with the previous ruling, the court has the power to impose financial sanctions on the member state. And I think we've seen recently in Ireland, with regard to the absence of environmental impact assessments before a certain wind farm was created, that just such an Article 260 judgment was handed down by the Court of Justice. And there's one last part of this infringement mechanism that I would like to highlight. One of the main ways in which the union institutions, and particularly the European Parliament and the Council, create rules, and this would also cover the environmental field, is by means of directives. And directives, we always say, are sort of funny creatures. They're incomplete in their nature because they tell the member state what it is that they're to do, but they don't tell them how to do it. The member state has to bring the directive into national law to make certain choices. And after that, individuals and companies, they access their rights that are given by union law by means of the national transposing legislation. Well, when you describe that system, it becomes obvious that if member states are late in implementing, if they're late in transposing directives, we have a problem. We have a problem because the credibility of union law as a whole is undermined. And we have a problem because the rights that are created for individuals are being withheld from them because the member state has failed to act in good time. Under Article 260, paragraph 3 of the TFEU, of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, the Commission can take a fast-track procedure before the Court of Justice. Similar to the Article 260, paragraph 2 case. But in the fast track procedure, the Commission doesn't have to get a judgment that there's been a failure to comply with obligations and then go back to court a number of years later to get financial sanctions. Under Article 260, paragraph 3, if there has been a failure to notify measures that transpose a directive in good time, then the Commission can bring an action against the member state already looking for financial sanctions to be imposed. And that's something that the Commission has been using much more in recent years. It has announced in 2017 that its standard approach in the event of late transposition would be to start proceedings going to court. And it used to be the case that the Commission in Article 260, paragraph 3 cases, would start a case and the case would advance. And if the member state transposed the directive before the Court of Justice had given its judgment, the Commission would stop the case. There was even one instance where the member state transposed the day before the court was scheduled to hand down its judgment, and the Commission withdrew the case. The Commission abandoned that approach about 3 years ago. And so now once the Commission starts one of these cases, it will carry through to the very end. And that, I think, increases the credibility of this mechanism, and it makes it easier for individuals to get access to the environmental law rights and that the union institutions have sought to create for them. I realize that this has been a very long response, but basically three mechanisms. First, preliminary rulings from national courts. The Commission always intervenes and tells the court what it thinks the answer is. Second, the Commission enforces the rules itself and its decisions are challengeable. And we then defend those decisions on the grounds that they're in line with the environmental law requirements. I would say more often than not, we win, but nobody's perfect. And finally, we have infringement actions.
You've covered so many important issues there, Leo, and covered them in such a clear and concise fashion as well. I suppose picking up in particular on the vital role of the national judge, the really important role then of the preliminary reference procedure. And interestingly, you mentioned, of course, the influence not just on European Union law, but of course on national environmental law as well of the Aarhus Convention. And I suppose to say that those are themes that have also surfaced in the other podcasts that we've prepared for this series. And I think the Aarhus Convention certainly is standing out as something that is particularly powerful and continues to have what I would describe, I suppose, as a fairly dramatic influence on how the law is continuing to evolve all the time, of course, in the interests of further and better environmental protection and underpinning the rule of law. With a view, I suppose, to pulling together our discussion this morning, is there one particular standout development or something that stands out as being particularly effective to enable enforcement of EU environmental law? Is there something that springs to mind briefly in that regard?
I would point to the change of policy with regard to Article 260, paragraph 3. That is to say, going to the court if there is late implementation of directives and looking for financial sanctions, because I think that the union legal system is not just in relation to national courts and the union courts, but with regard to national administrations and the union level administration, with regard to national legislatures and union legislature, it's a hybrid system. And then we have a problem if one member state or several member states are late in implementing directives. It means that individuals who live in those countries are at a disadvantage compared with their counterparts elsewhere in the union. And that, I think, is a problem in general terms when we're looking at a union of peoples and of member states, because it means that there isn't equality of treatment, that some member states have made a big effort and others don't deliver and there don't appear to be consequences. Secondly, it's not good in terms of the credibility of the union as a system of governance, either because basically, all of us are familiar that when legislation is proposed, there are big announcements. And then when legislation is adopted, there are big announcements. But it's not until the legislation is actually being enforced that it can deliver change, that it can do what people expect it to do. And so even though it's not maybe super sexy, I think that ensuring that directives are put in place in a timely fashion is really significant. And for the field of the environment, I think that it's long been observed that some member states can be really slow to implement some or all of directives. And directives are, I think, the most important legal instrument which is used in the field of environmental protection. Now, all of this, as I say, presupposes that directives are being adopted. And you could ask yourself the question, well, is enough legislation being adopted? Should more legislation be put in place? Should there be higher standards? That maybe is a debate, I don't know, for people who are more au fait with the environmental policy dimension. It's maybe a discussion that political scientists can have. It's also probably good to say that just churning out more legislation doesn't always deliver real improvement. Effective application, ultimately, is what's most important. But once the rules are adopted, if they're not transposed into national law, we have a very basic challenge. And I think that by the Commission basically saying we will not apply a discretionary approach, we will go directly to the court under Article 260, paragraph 3, then the Commission, I think, is doing more to deliver for the citizen and in the field of environmental law for the union's environment.
I think I'd have to agree fully with everything you've said there, Leo, in particular the vital importance of timely transposition, and then having the backup of the financial sanction where that is necessary, with a view again to ensuring that things move along as they should do and that there's no lag from the member state side. And again, you've managed in a very short space of time to hit on so many important issues and to make them so clear for our audience. So Leo Flynn, thank you so much for joining us today and for those fascinating insights, not only into your own work and your own career, but into a whole range of vitally important issues concerning the environment and environmental protection. Thank you.